With medical experts from Mayo Clinic, Johns Hopkins, the Cleveland Clinic, and more, this is Med Clinic Radio.
Med Clinic Radio.
Exploring the latest developments in health and medicine and what they mean to you. Here's your host, Gina Tedesco.
Liver cancer is a leading cause of cancer deaths worldwide. Now, the Cleveland Clinic is the first hospital in the world to use a recently approved technique to destroy large liver tumors, and we'll talk to the doctor who led the effort. Then, millions of Americans suffer from hearing loss. We'll talk to an author who outlines some surprising health effects connected to the problem and explain why many of us won't admit it's time for a hearing aid or other help. And depression in American children may be at an all-time high, but we'll look at a study that found that team sports can lead to less depression in kids as young as 9. That's all straight ahead on this week's Med Clinic Radio.
Welcome back to Med Clinic Radio. Once again, here's Gina Tedesco.
Cleveland Clinic has become the first hospital in the world to treat a patient with a large liver tumor using ablation technology that the FDA recently approved. The facility has since treated 3 more patients and reports all 4 procedures were successes. Joining us now to explain this development and its importance is Cleveland Clinic's Dr. Aaron Berber, who led a team that performed the procedures. He's also director of the Robotic Endocrine Surgery Neuroendocrine Adrenal Tumor Center, and he directs the Surgical Liver Tumor Ablation Program. Doctor, welcome. Now, please put this into context for us. In the big picture, would you call this a major advance in treating large liver tumors?
Yes, it's a major advance in treating large tumors and also in treating liver tumors in general.
Now, with this approach, there's much less cutting than an open surgical procedure, of course. How much of an advantage does that hold for the liver cancer patient?
We know that the gold standard for treating liver cancer is cutting it out by what we call liver resection. And that's a pretty good treatment. The issue is that most patients are not candidates for this procedure because either they have too much liver involvement or they are not so fit to undergo a major liver resection. And the recovery is also a little bit involved. Whereas with these alternative technologies, if you are able to do the procedure for small incisions, like gallbladder surgery, you can treat the liver cancer, and then you can also ensure a short recovery for the patient. Obviously, when we are doing these treatments, we also want to make sure that we follow what we call oncologic principles, meaning that, okay, we are sending the patient home early, but are we doing a good cancer treatment? With the advances of these ablation technologies, with the introduction of the more powerful technologies like the one we are talking about, actually, we are also ensuring that we are doing a good cancer operation for the patient.
And what type of ablation do you use to kill these large tumors in the liver? Alcohol, radio frequency, or another?
Actually, the history of ablation treatments for liver tumors is pretty interesting. It initially started by freezing the tumors, something called cryoablation, in the 1990s. However, the efficacy was not good, so a lot of tumors were not being fully treated, and then there were a lot of complications. Then early 2000s, this new treatment that used actually heat instead by using a technology called radiofrequency ablation, which is kind of like alternating electrical current. And then you basically, by using this alternating electrical current, you are creating a frictional heat and you warm the cancer up. And if you are able to raise the temperature above a certain degree, which tends to be actually 50 degrees Celsius, then you kill the cancer cells. And this was actually a big breakthrough in early 2000. A lot of patients underwent this treatment, but we soon realized that it wasn't good enough because 1 out of 3 tumors was basically persisting or coming back where you treat it. And then over the last 10 years, we are able to provide this heating, the burning, to through another technology called microwave ablation. Microwave is what we use in our kitchen every day, and this is just kind of obviously sophisticated medical technology to use microwave principles to create the heat. This heat that is created with microwave is much higher and much faster and evenly distributed around the tumor, and hence you're able to perform a better tumor destruction. And we see this in our results as well. When we compare the patients who had their treatments done by radiofrequency ablation versus this new treatment, microwave ablation, we see that the failures of the treatment are much less.
We're visiting with Dr. Aaron Berber of the Cleveland Clinic's Surgical Liver Tumor Ablation Program about their ability to ablate large liver tumors with technology that the FDA recently approved. Doctor, I want you to pick up on what you were just saying, that you say the success of ablation has improved in recent years. How do we define success?
That's a very good question. So the success for these what we call ablational therapies or burning treatments is measured by how often the cancer that you burn is turned into scar tissue and how often does it come back where you treated it. The medical term is like local recurrence or local success rate. For radiofrequency ablation, 3 out of 10 tumors that were burned with this technologies was coming back. Whereas with this microwave technology, only 1 out of 10 tumors that you burn fails at the treatment site. So that's a great significant achievement. And then with these newer technologies, now the door is open to treat even bigger tumors that we were not able to treat well in the past because of the limitation of the energy. And a lot of those patients were either going to other treatment options or maybe they were undergoing liver resection, meaning cutting them out with a much longer recovery.
And the first patient that you treated, I know, with this new technique had a 2.4-inch tumor. And yet, as you were just discussing, with this new technology, you're able to create 6 or 7 centimeter burns with a single stick. What do you think is the maximum size then of a tumor that you could ablate with this new technology?
Before this newer technology announcement, we were able to offer these treatments for tumors as big as 4 centimeters, which is like 1.5 inches. Now, because of the larger burn we can create with a single stick, we can expand that size limit up to 6 centimeters, which would be close to 2.5 inches.
Up next on MedClinic Radio, we learn more about this advance in technology to ablate large liver tumors. Back in a moment.
Return to MedClinic Radio with your host, Gina Tedesco.
We're back now with Cleveland Clinic's Dr. Aaron Berber, who led a team that performed the ablations to kill large liver tumors, first in the world, using a recently FDA-approved ablation technology. He's also director of the Surgical Liver Tumor Ablation Program. Doctor, walk us through the procedure. First, is this performed under general anesthesia in an OR or in a procedure room with local anesthesia?
We perform this procedure under general anesthesia in the operating room.
And you use a laparoscopic camera and ultrasound probe. How are you using these?
So when the patient presents to the operating room, they receive general anesthesia, so they don't feel any pain. And after that, we obviously prepare the abdomen with sterile solutions and make 2 small cuts in the right upper quadrant of the abdomen. And these are about 1 centimeter each, which is kind of a little bit less than 0.5 inch. And then fructose, we introduce a special camera. We call it a laparoscopic camera. It's like a camera at the end of a stick. So we're able to look around the abdomen, look around, making sure that there's nothing else going on. And through the other small cut, we introduce another stick that has an ultrasound surface on it. And we put that ultrasound stick right on top of the liver, and we investigate and scan the liver with this ultrasound. And just one piece of information, this ultrasound, which we call intraoperative ultrasound, where you put the ultrasound probe right on top of the liver, is the most sensitive imaging that can be done to investigate the number as well as the size of tumors in the liver. And sometimes with this technology, just like a site information, we find additional tumors that are not picked up by the scans done before the surgery.
I see.
And after we identify and localize the tumors in the liver, then we get ready to burn it with this ablation technology.
And then you insert that needle from outside the body right into the tumor, and the microwave burns the tumor?
Yeah, the tumor is very small. The needle is very small, so you introduce a very small additional incision. So most patients end up having three small cuts in their abdomen. And by using ultrasound guidance, so we want to see the needle going through the liver into the tumor, we then activate the energy, and depends on the size of the tumor. It could be anywhere from a couple of minutes to 10, 15 minutes. We apply the energy to create our burn.
And when you position the needle, do you attempt to reach, as best you could, the very center of the lesion and then not move the needle?
Exactly. You know, we first target the middle of the needle, but you would appreciate that some of the tumors, some of the cancers, they are irregular. That's their nature. And we monitor the what we call the ablation process, so, you know, how the burn is forming with the ultrasound. And if we feel that one part of the tumor is not being covered by the ultrasound, by the ablation on ultrasound, then we move the needle to a separate spot and burn that area as well. And that ensures that the whole tumor is covered by this burn.
Doctor, how much, if any, of the healthy liver tissue do you have to burn in order to create a margin between the tumor and the healthy tissue?
The margin is very important for the success or the outcome of these ablation treatments. A lot of studies show that the larger the burn around the cancer, the less the chances of it coming back where you burn it. So we try to achieve at least a centimeter, which is a little bit less than half an inch of circumference margin around the tumor. Sometimes this is restricted by the critical structures nearby, and you might have to adjust your margin to make sure that you don't burn any critical structures. But if you don't have any restriction, we try to achieve as large margin as possible, at least a centimeter, half an inch around the tumor.
And how can you tell when the lesion is dead and effectively the procedure has done all it can do?
Obviously, we have our algorithms, and based on our previous experience, our follow-up data, you know, at the Cleveland Clinic, we have this prospective program. So every patient gets scans every 3 months after the surgery for the first 2 years, so we can correlate failures and successes with our ablation algorithm. Like, you know, like in brief, like how long did they burn one tumor and what was the outcome? And then based on that, kind of we make adjustments to our ablation algorithms that we use. I mean, like what power setting for how long? And then based on that historical information, we perform our burn for a standardized period of time around the tumor, and we monitor and confirm that with ultrasound that we use during the operation.
We've been talking with Dr. Aaron Berber of the Cleveland Clinic Surgical Liver Tumor Ablation Program about their ability to ablate large liver tumors. In addition to the monitoring, doctor, do you also do on-the-spot biopsy of areas around the dead tumor to confirm that no cancerous cells are left?
That's a good point. Actually, some studies have been done to look at the utility of that. But based on our clinical experience, that is not necessary. If you can cover the tumor well and see that on ultrasound, then you don't need to do a biopsy. The biopsies we do for patients who come to the operating room without a tissue diagnosis before the surgery. In those patients, before we treat, we do the biopsies. And sometimes you find additional spots in the liver and you're not sure if they're cancer or not, then we do a biopsy while the patient is asleep in order to kind of figure out if the additional spots you're seeing are cancers or not.
Are there risks associated with this procedure? And if so, what might they be?
Obviously, with any surgical procedure, there are some risks involved. Any surgical procedure has a small chance of bleeding and small chance of infection, as well as some risks related to being in the hospital, such as infections, blood clots, colitis, things like that. But luckily, this treatment is associated with a very small chance of complications. In our patients, out of 100 patients that we treat, I see problems 5 out of 100. And obviously with experience, the severity of these complications is also negligible. But theoretically, whenever you do surgery, we always talk to patients about, 1% chance of bleeding, maybe similar chance of infection. But overall, we see problems 5 out of 100 patients.
And doctor, you hinted about this a little earlier on, but who are the best candidates for this type of procedure? And if you could address those with cirrhosis and how that plays in on your decision as to whether they would be a good candidate for this.
So as I wanted to emphasize, like, this treatment is not replacing the gold standard treatment of liver resection, cutting them out. But the best candidates are patients who are not fit to undergo a major liver resection procedure. They may be elderly, they might not be as functional as younger patients, or they might have some other medical problems, heart or lung problems. They might not be able to tolerate the long, big operation. The second group of patients are those patients with smaller tumors whose cutting procedure, the resection procedure, would have to remove a lot of liver tissue in order to remove that small tumor. So there's an imbalance between the size of the tumor and how much liver you have to remove. Sometimes you have to remove half of the liver if something is located very deep in the liver. So those patients are also really good candidates for this treatment. This is like the new concept that has been originating over the last decade in liver surgery. We call it parenchymal preservation, which means that preserve as much liver tissue as you can when treating cancer. And the other group of patients are actually those patients who have extensive disease where you can combine this treatment together with cutting them out so that you provide a really good treatment for patients with more extensive disease who may not be candidates for either treatment alone.
Well, doctor, I want to wish you the very best with all your efforts, and I appreciate your time today. Dr. Aaron Berber of the Cleveland Clinic's Surgical Liver Tumor Ablation Program. I want to thank you again for joining us today about this microwave ablation technique.
Thanks for having me.
Still ahead, we learn about the latest scientific and legal advances for the millions who suffer from hearing loss. That's next as MedClinic Radio continues.
With your Mayo Clinic Radio Health Minute, I'm Joel Streed. Rather than planning out arbitrary amounts of fluids during your workout, your body is the best indicator when you need to be hydrated. Drink when you're thirsty.
You can become dehydrated if you take in too little, and you can actually cause problems such as exercise-induced low sodium or hyponatremia if you take in too much. So the general rule of thumb at this point among physicians is to drink to thirst.
Dr. Sarah Filmalter says when you sweat, your body is losing fluid along with those electrolytes such as sodium and chloride.
I typically recommend that they consume about half their fluids in water and half their fluids in a beverage that contains electrolytes without an enormous amount of sugar. The purpose of rehydrating is to pull fluid back into our system and rehydrate so our organs are happy.
So during the next workout, remember to drink to thirst and hydrate your body with good sports beverages and good old H2O. For more information, talk with your healthcare provider or visit mayoclinic.org.
You're listening to MedClinic Radio, exploring the latest developments in health and medicine and what they mean to you. Once again, here's Gina Tedesco.
The National Center for Health Statistics estimates that 37 million Americans have some problem with their hearing, but there are scientific and legal advances that we should all know about. Joining us here on MedClinic Radio is David Owen, staff writer for The New Yorker, author of the book Volume Control, Hearing in a Deafening World. David, first off, how's your hearing?
My hearing's not too bad. I have this problem that millions of people have, which is called tinnitus. It's a ringing, a kind of phantom sound in my ears all the time, a high-pitched ringing, and I'm usually able to ignore it. It's hard to ignore it when I'm thinking about it, as I am right now, but it's a common problem, and it's almost always associated with some degree of hearing loss.
Now, you write that people who are hard of hearing die younger on average than people who can hear well. Why is that?
There are a lot of reasons. It's associated with things like heart disease, diabetes, low birth weight. Exposure to loud sounds creates stress. And as the hearing difficulties become more severe, people who have suffered hearing loss tend to become socially isolated. Hearing loss is associated with cognitive decline. The idea is that as you withdraw from other people, you cease to receive the kind of stimulation that you did from contact with other human beings.
There are also some practical concerns. For example, if a fire alarm is a loud blaring noise and you can't hear it, you could be in big trouble.
Oh, sure. If you can't hear that your car is still running and you leave it running in your garage and you go upstairs and the house fills with carbon monoxide, hearing is incredibly important and we tend to take it for granted. You know, I think back over my youth, I'm 64 years old now. You know, I mowed lawns, I used power tools, I fired guns at summer camp. My friends and I threw firecrackers at each other. We never gave a thought to our ears. Some of the population that suffers the most from hearing loss tend to be veterans. Hearing loss and tinnitus are the number one and number two most common service-related health claims made by veterans. The Veterans Administration is the largest single purchaser of hearing aids in the United States.
And that's an interesting point because you've said that grown-ups often assume that teenagers listening to loud music through earbuds are the most at risk of losing their hearing, but that's just not true, as you're saying.
Yeah, everybody's at risk. I think modern life is loud. And young people tend to think, oh, well, deafness is a problem for old people. And it is, but it's a problem that begins in youth. It's cumulative. It begins when you're young. Often, you know, I think of the rock concerts I went to more of them when I was in my teens and 20s than I do now. And that has a lifelong impact. I think people also tend to think, oh, well, you know, I'll screw up my ears and then I'll get hearing aids. Hearing aids are great. People need them. They're fantastic. People wait too long to get them when they need them. But they don't make up for hearing that's been completely lost. You know, if you have bad eyesight, if you have myopia, you get a pair of glasses and you put them on, you see perfectly. With hearing, if you've lost the ability to detect certain frequency ranges, nothing gives that back. It's an infrastructure problem inside your head, and there's no workaround for it.
So let's turn to the changes. Is there anything new in the laws protecting workers on the job from loud noises that would damage their hearing?
The laws have been around for a long time. They date back to the 1970s, and they're better than nothing, but they're not complete. Even at the time, they weren't sufficient to protect all covered workers from job-related hearing loss. And now, I think the understanding of how hearing loss works has evolved to the point where it's understood that many more of those workers are at risk. And then there are all the jobs that are not covered by federal law. You know, people who mow lawns, carpenters, people who work on oil rigs, they're not covered industries. The guy mowing your lawn is more likely to be wearing hearing protection now than he was 10 years ago, but there's still a lot of unprotected people.
You say the biggest technological advance for improving hearing is a cochlear implant. What is that, and how does it differ from a hearing aid?
In people who've lost all their hearing or have essentially no hearing in an ear. It's this really remarkable prosthesis that bypasses the existing middle ear and inner ear. It feeds a wire into the inner ear and then feeds electrical signals directly to the nerves that communicate with the auditory centers of the brain. You can go on YouTube and see the heartwarming videos of people having their cochlear implants turned on. The actual effect is somewhat different. It's not like hearing the way a person with normal hearing hears. It's a much less rich input, but still, it's been a transformative innovation for people who need it. At the Mass Eye and Ear Hearing Center in Boston, Massachusetts, I talked with a woman who had, she had a brand new cochlear implant on one side and she had a hearing aid on the other side. And I never would have known if I hadn't known that she had a hearing problem at all, because we carried on what seemed to me like a perfectly normal conversation. To her, our conversation, she described it as like Alvin and the Chipmunks sometimes, or like a very computery kind of sound, or like extremely scratchy, poorly received AM radio. But still, we were able to talk.
We're visiting with David Owen, staff writer for The New Yorker, author of the book Volume Control, Hearing in a Deafening World. Now, you've said that hearing aids are improving and becoming more versatile, and the decades-old laws and business practices that made them less affordable are changing. Can you give us one example?
Anybody who has them knows how expensive they are, but you can now beginning now to buy devices that are essentially hearing aids, whether they're called them or not. I have a pair of Bose headphones called Hearphones. They have the same kind of processor that hearing aids do. They're a fraction of the cost. They cost $500. They have better fidelity than hearing aids do. They're bigger. They have a more robust version of Bluetooth. The only downside is that unlike hearing aids, they've not been optimized for invisibility. I have to be willing for everybody to be able to see them in order to use them. And in a restaurant where hearing is challenged, even for people who have pretty good hearing, they're great. You know, they make it possible to focus in on a speaker to silence some of the background sound, and I love them.
You were talking about the cost just a second ago. If people think they can't afford a visit to a medical professional to get the hearing aids, they need to know that's all changed now, right?
It's changing. It hasn't all changed yet, but I think there's some low-cost opportunities. At Mass Eye and Ear now, all inpatients who don't have hearing aids but need them are provided with an inexpensive device, less than $100, that makes it possible for them to hear their doctor. The hospital decided that one of the reasons that people aren't very good at doing what they're supposed to, what their doctors tell them, is that they simply didn't hear it. And the doctors have been trained, too, to make sure that they've turned off the TV, that the patient has the device in, that they're looking at each other and paying attention. So, you know, I got a pair of these for my mother. It's called Super Ear. They cost $75 or $80. And, you know, she's hesitant to wear them in public, but they gave her a taste of what hearing aids would do for her if she decided to get them.
And there are apps for smartphones for helping people hear. Can you pick one and tell us about it?
There's one called Ear Machine. It's free. If you search for Ear Machine, it actually was invented by the people who invented the software for earphones. It doesn't have noise cancellation, but it lets you use your phone as the microphone for a hearing device. It needs wired headphones. The reason is that with Bluetooth, there's a lag. It takes time to process an audio signal. So there's a lag between, for example, when the person sitting across from you speaks and when you hear it, and it can drive people crazy to see voice and lips not sync together. So you need wired headphones, but it's free. You can see what hearing aids can do for you, and you can adjust it yourself, which is something that typically cannot be done with conventional hearing aids.
Finally, what is the latest on efforts to treat people, particularly children, with hearing loss due to a genetic defect?
The scientists that I've talked to, there are lots of scientists working on reversing hearing loss. The widespread belief is that there will be treatments, effective treatments, for some kinds of genetic hearing loss before there are for the kind of hearing loss caused by exposure to loud sounds. And the reason is that it's easier to turn on or turn off an individual gene than it is to reconfigure this incredibly complex, yet also incredibly tiny auditory infrastructure inside our heads. But all the, you know, sort of the miracle cures are still years away. Nevertheless, there are serious people all over the country, all over the world, working very hard to come up with solutions, full solutions, to people with hearing problems.
And more to come. David Owen, author of Volume Control, Hearing in a Deafening World. Thank you for joining us today.
Oh, thank you.
Next, can kids who participate in team sports have greater brain development at lower rates of depression? We'll find out in a moment on MedClinic Radio.
Welcome back to MedClinic Radio. Once again, here's Gina Tedesco.
Depression among young people is a growing problem, but a study from Washington University in St. Louis is among the first to show that participation in team sports may serve as a sort of antidepressant for preteens. This after other studies showed a similar positive impact of exercise on adults. For kids who play team sports, researchers noticed a change to their brains. Joining us now is the study's lead author, Professor Deanna Bartsch, who chairs the Department of Psychology and Brain Sciences in Arts and Sciences. Professor, your study made several key findings, but let's take them one at a time. First, when boys or girls play sports under certain conditions, a region of their brains appears to increase. What is that region and what does it do?
We found a very interesting relationship between participation in sports and the volume of a region of the brain called the hippocampus. And the hippocampus is very interesting because it's a part of the brain that's really important for helping us to control our responses to stress and emotion regulation. And so it's a region of the brain where when it's intact and working functionally, it helps us be able to effectively sort of respond to stress and not to have kind of negative reactions to stress.
And what benefit did you notice in boys, but not in girls?
In the boys, but not girls, we also saw that involvement in sports was associated with less depression. And importantly, it seemed to be that that relationship between being involved in sports and depression, part of that relationship seems to go through the fact that sports was associated with increased hippocampal volume. And our hypothesis is that that might be associated with better stress regulation, better able to deal with, you know, negative events in one's life, which might be associated with less likelihood of developing depression.
And your study found the most profound results with kids playing structured sports. Now, what does that mean and what intriguing possibilities does that raise?
We actually found it was related to both team sports and structured sports. And Lisa Gorham, who's the first author on the paper, who's a student athlete herself, she actually had a very interesting idea going into the study, the idea that team sports and structured sports not only provide the benefit of the exercise, but also the sort of camaraderie and social support that might be involved in being part of a team, you know, having a regular time where you have to participate in sports, having a coach and so on, and that those may be additional benefits for kids over and above the sort of physiological benefits of engaging in exercise.
Now, just to clarify, your study does not conclude that playing sports causes less depression in boys, but merely that reduced depression shows up, shall we say, when they play sports. Is that right?
Right, exactly. So we don't know from these findings whether it's the case that engaging in sports actually creates a larger hippocampus and leads to less depression, or whether it's the case that kids who are less depressed to start out with are more able to engage in sports and, you know, might have a larger hippocampal volume. So we don't know sort of the causal direction, although this particular project is one where we will follow kids over time, and that will give us more opportunity to try to understand which might be leading to which.
And even though the girls did not experience the reduced depression, can we infer that they might be experiencing other benefits related to having a larger volume of the hippocampus?
Yeah, that's an interesting hypothesis. One of the things we'd like to look at in future work is how this may also relate to memory and thinking and cognitive function and school performance. There's also some reasons to think that the hippocampus is really important for memory as well. And so one of the things we'd like to look at is whether maybe both boys and girls show some association between involvement in sports and better memory and thinking skills, and whether that, again, is associated with a larger hippocampal volume.
We're visiting with Professor Deanna Bartsch, who chairs the Department of Psychology and Brain Sciences in Arts and Sciences at Washington University School of Medicine. Professor, We've all heard that when exercising vigorously for 45 minutes, our body releases endorphins, making us happy. But can you draw a distinction here? Are the benefits of those just a sort of one-off, whereas what you studied may indicate a longer-lasting benefit for kids?
Yes, exactly. In the moment when we're exercising, people do often report exactly what you said, you know, that they get potentially through release of endorphins, a temporary increase in positive mood. But it could be that if people regularly engage in sports and exercise over time, that you might get a longer lasting benefit to mood and affect that might be due to changes in some of these brain regions. There's interesting data from adults that does suggest that to be true. And this is something we're certainly interested in finding out whether it might also be true in children.
And let's understand the study a bit deeper. You started with more than 4,100 youngsters who were part of a study on adolescents and their learning. How did your researchers follow up on their rates of depression and determine their hippocampus sizes?
This is an interesting study that's being run across the entire United States, actually 21 different places in the U.S. And we invite children and their families to participate. And they come in and the parents tell us a lot about what kids are doing in terms of their involvement in sports. And both the parents and the kids tell us about how they're feeling currently in terms of depression and maybe whether kids have had depression in the past. And then the kids participate in what we call an MRI scan, which is magnetic resonance imaging. It's the same kind of scan that you might have gotten if you've ever broken a limb or hit your head. We just use it in a way that lets us actually measure the volume of different brain regions. And then we have some ways of looking at that information after we've gotten the scans from children that allow us to determine the different volume sizes for different kids. And we're having the kids, or asking them, to come back every year to continue to tell us what kinds of things they're doing in their life, what their mood's like. We will ask them to do MRI scans again every couple years so we can look at this over time and see whether, for example, continued involvement in sports, particularly team sports or structured sports, whether that's associated with continued increase in hippocampal volume or continued reduction in depression, so we can get a little bit more at cause and effect.
Does the sports intensity make a difference in how much benefit the child receives?
Another great question. We unfortunately can't look at that in our study because we don't have any like direct measures of how intensely kids are exercising. You might make some guesses based on the type of sport, but that's pretty hard to do because lots of different sports can be done at different levels of intensity. We have a little bit of information about what we might call a dose response curve, where you can sort of sum up how many hours it seems that kids have been involved. And there does seem to be a relationship there, but we don't really have a way of looking at the sort of intensity in the moment.
But in any event, can you characterize how important are your findings to understanding childhood depression?
I think they are very important because regardless of which direction the cause is, whether it's depressed kids are less likely to be involved in sports or being involved in sports makes you less depressed, both point to potential pathways for interventions that might help kids. So if it turns out that being depressed kind of gets in the way of kids being involved in sports, it might point to interventions that try to re-engage kids in activities like sports. And if it turns out that sports really is preventative of depression, we certainly might want to think about how we make sure that all kids have equal opportunities to participate in the kinds of sports that might be helpful.
Professor, I do have to ask you this one big picture question. Many parents are concerned about certain contact sports and the risk of concussion. So just to be clear, what we're talking about, the larger volume of the hippocampus would not sort of undo brain injuries. Is that correct?
We don't know the answer to that. I don't think we can say that the benefit of potentially having a larger hippocampal volume would outweigh the potential risk of head injury. This is actually something we'll be looking at in this study as well, tracking kids' reports and parents' reports of whether they've had a traumatic brain injury as a function of being involved in sports or something else. And so that is actually a question we'll be able to address more directly over time.
We'll look forward to your follow-ups. Professor Deanna Bartsch of Washington University School of Medicine, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
And that's MedClinic Radio for this week. MedClinic Radio is a production of Syndication Networks. If you would like to listen to past shows, check out our website, medclinicradio.com. Our executive producer is Randy Meyer, and I'm your host, Gina Tedesco. Thanks for joining us, and we hope you join us again next week for another edition of MedClinic Radio. Syndication Network.